Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I'm joined today by Bruegel's Guntram Wolf and Nicolas Véran, and we are going to talk about what is going on with Ukraine. We are recording this on a Tuesday after a very exciting weekend where the U.S. was associated with a 28-point plan, possibly to end hostilities or tamp them down between Russia and Ukraine. The European Union did not like this plan very much and worked very hard to come up with its own. There have been talks in Geneva. There are arguments about money. And the EU is trying to figure out what exactly it can do to stay close to its NATO allies and also Ukraine and deal with Russia not so very far away. Guntram, how do we work through this? Can you explain to us the dueling plans on the table and what's at stake?
I would start by saying it's a great question, and I think we are all trying to figure out what exactly is in the plans and what has been proposed by whom. But I think the bottom line is that there was a proposal on a 28-points plan floating on the weekend. Then there was lots of debate. Where did this plan come from? Then at some stage, the US president seemed to endorse the plan, then walking back again. So there was a lot of, I would say, confusion, and I would say also evidence that at least parts of the plan were literal translations from Russian to English. So we have had all of that. But I think on the substance, the original version of the plan that was posted also on the website of the Financial Times, for example, would have implied a very, very difficult and precarious situation for Ukraine itself. In particular, what shocked me the most were 2 points. I mean, the first was an implied commitment by Ukraine to actually reduce its armed forces very substantially. And that's, of course, something that you cannot do when you have the big neighbor right next door in this aggressive posture. So it would have really left Ukraine very vulnerable. The other point that I think was really, really difficult was this idea that first Ukraine would have to withdraw its troops from its current positions to essentially hand Russia significant territories that Russia has been trying to occupy for some time, including in the Donbas. But then basically only after the withdrawal of these troops would the rest of the plan have been activated. And that would have, first of all, meant that Ukraine be in a position quite behind the current defensive positions. And that means a big disadvantage because you have to dig in, as we know, to sort of defend territory. And it would have meant that Russia could just have said, okay, thanks for giving me that territory, and now we continue, right? And so the plan was totally not thought through from the perspective of Ukraine and from the perspective of the West. Therefore, I think it's quite plausible that it was actually a pretty Russian-inspired plan. And so European leaders worked, I would say, very hard to overcome this and to change the direction. And they made a counter-proposal. And I think they really gave these 3 red lines, which at least the U.S. Foreign Minister Marco Rubio has understood and I think endorsed, which are basically, first of all, the start of the territorial negotiations needs to be the current line of combat. Second, Ukraine does not have to reduce its active forces. And third, anything that concerns the EU, be that sanctions, be that Russian assets, cannot be decided trilaterally between the US, Ukraine, and Russia.
Nicolas, I wanted you to walk us through the money side of this. The EU has been negotiating among itself a way to work with Euroclear, the securities depository in Belgium, to take advantage of the cash that's been piling up as the frozen or immobilized Russian central bank reserves continue to sit there, unable to be accessed by Russia. We now have a situation where the EU thought that it had come up with a way to preserve international law, tap the money, and also reduce the immediate financial risk to anybody involved, and to use some of that cash then to help Ukraine. But now the US has come in and said that they want to get in the middle of it and perhaps take some cut out of the deal in some way as well. We see that in these dueling plans. Can you tell us what is going on, and will this upset the apple cart even more?
Well, as Guntram has hinted at, a lot is going on, and a lot of this is very murky and chaotic. So I don't have a full answer to your question, and things are changing by the hour. As you said, the EU has come up, and that came in September in Ursula von der Leyen's State of the Union speech, with a clever plan. This is said without irony. It's a very elegant piece of proposed financial engineering that resolves many problems in a pretty effective way. That's a reparations loan. And we can discuss it, but essentially, as you said, it's a way to take advantage of the fact that Russian cash is piling up at Euroclear to provide funding to Ukraine in a way that is favorable in terms of funding conditions and also, frankly, political parameters without breaching international law and without expropriating Russia from its property of the cash piles that they have in deposit at Euroclear. That's still the plan. It's being negotiated. We know that there are oppositions in some member states, including crucially Belgium, where Euroclear is located. There is also a lot going on politically in Belgium these days. As you may have noticed, there's a strike. There is a government that has been teetering on the edge of a breakout of their coalition. At this point, it looks like they will live another day under the leadership of Prime Minister Bardo Wever. But the Belgian context is important, I guess, to understand the dynamics of the negotiation of the reparations loan. Who knows what will happen in the next few days? But my assessment at the time of recording is that the reparations loan remains a baseline scenario because it solves so many problems for Europeans and Ukrainians without breaching international law. So that's a baseline scenario. What are the alternative scenarios? If the reparations loan for some reason cannot happen, then the EU, in my assessment, will continue to support Ukraine financially, but will have to do it on its own means, which, by the way, it has been doing for 3.5 years. So it's not really new, but that's increasingly painful as the cost of supporting Ukraine increases, which is normal in a war. The idea that the US, let alone Russia, could take that money sounds completely outlandish. It is outlandish. It is not clear what arguments the US is putting forward, or Russia for that matter, are putting forward to support that idea. I think at this point we know so little about the context in which this proposal was made that it is just speculation in terms of what may be the implications going forward.
The US alleged plan seems to be trying to present Washington as a mediator in between Russia and Ukraine and in between Russia and Europe, and saying somehow that the US would be more trustworthy as being in the middle of all of this. This just seems bizarre on a number of levels, not to mention the fact that the US and the EU and the UK have been NATO members and allies for a very long time. But do you share that sense that that was part of the justification for why the US should have more control over things like the borders and the money and a lot of things that would seem to be the purview of the people on the ground?
Well, I mean, let me just say the most, perhaps most funny, if it wasn't funny, point of the 28 plan was the suggestion that the US would mediate between NATO and Russia, which is, of course, a pretty ridiculous statement, given that the US is the most important member of NATO and has been absolutely central in shaping core NATO policies over the last decades. Now, I think that clause is gone, but I think what, of course, is implicitly there is I think in the US, a certain, at least among the president and some MAGA people, a certain admiration for Putin's Russia and a Putin way of doing things and business sort of business kind of dealings approach to a foreign policy issue. And that is deeply concerning for any European that, of course, thinks that Putin is not only an authoritarian regime, it's an authoritarian regime that is not only authoritarian domestically, suppressing minority opinions, putting people in jail without fair trial, but is actually highly aggressive outside, is abducting children from Ukraine, is committing war crimes, etc., etc. So to think that the US has actually some sympathy for that kind of a regime is a deeply terrifying thing for any European. And I think European leaders should have seen this for several years. I mean, we know that Trump has this approach and has these views, and many people in MAGA have these views. And I think it is our responsibility as Europeans to overcome our critical dependencies on the US that make us so vulnerable to these kind of blackmailing. I think at the end of the day, this means investment into hard military power, which is happening, but it could have been done faster early on. It also means supporting Ukraine more strategically and more forcefully, which I think is a big mistake still, that we are not really going full in supporting Ukraine. And it means having a clear strategic vision. And the strategic vision for Europe needs to be that Ukraine is absolutely fundamental for European security, and we need to support Ukraine as much as we can to ensure that it doesn't lose this war. Because if it loses this war, then next time we will not just be confronted with Russia, we will be confronted with Russia combined with Ukraine. So that's a big, big, big gain for Russia. And then the Ukrainian drone pilots that are currently shooting down Russian tanks will be Ukrainian drone pilots under the leadership of a Russian general shooting down Polish tanks.
That is a very dystopian future that we need to think about, or at least bear in mind, I guess. It seems there are a couple of different strands. We've, of course, got the long-term issue of European self-sufficiency versus its historic dependence on the U.S., but also the near-term issue of, is this an active plan to change the course of hostilities between Russia and Ukraine or not? And Nicola, I'd like to ask you the same question. Is the U.S. trying to position itself as somehow in the middle of this as opposed to on a side? And if so, is Europe's engaging with the plan, you know, with the talks in Geneva and trying to come up with its own, is it a way to try and wrest back the narrative, or what do you make of it?
So, as you know, I live partly in the US. I'm observing it both from kind of inside and outside, even so it's difficult to have direct conversations with Trump administration officials, because frankly, most of them, including at relatively senior level, have no idea what's going on. The difficulty for the US and for the US president, because this is a very personalized regime at this point, is that there are two contradictory impulses. One is what appears to be President Trump's worldview, which is thinking of the world in terms of spheres of influence and viewing Europe naturally as under the Russian sphere of influence, because Russia has big weapons and a big chunk of territories that makes it big on the map, and speaks the language of power and has an autocratic regime. So that's number one. Number two is the fact that the link with the EU is actually very valuable for the US. It's a multiplier of US power. It has been for a long time, since at least the end of World War II. And losing that alliance has a cost even for President Trump. And you see it in his trade policy. Let's not forget that the so-called trade deal between the EU and the US that was negotiated at Turnberry Gulf course is entirely predicated on US support, continued military support, not financial, but military support to Ukraine, which is also a way of saying if the US stops its military support to Ukraine for whatever reason, then it has a trade problem with the EU. That in the eyes of President Trump, it had resolved at Turnberry. So there are many parameters here that would keep the US on the side of supporting Ukraine militarily, as it currently apparently does, without giving financial support, which is now entirely in the hands of the EU. But at the end of the day, the decision maker will be Donald Trump, and it's, as we know, difficult to predict that kind of decision making.
It's just mind-boggling to think that Europe is considered part of Russia's sphere of influence, given the partitions that were between the U.S. and the Soviet Union for so much of the 20th century.
I want to make an additional point, if you allow, which is, I think, not sufficiently perceived in Europe, and perhaps even more so in the U.S., which is the very significant change of the parameters of support to Ukraine in the last 12 months. Let me explain. In the run-up to the US election about a year ago, or even in the aftermath of the US election, the consensus view, certainly among investors, I, like many others, had many conversations with investors at that time, but the consensus view was that if the US was to disengage from supporting Ukraine, including just on the financial side, and that had started under the Biden administration because of the Republican Congress, then there would be no choice for the EU to align with the US and to also disengage from supporting Ukraine financially. We have short memories, but that was the consensus 12 months ago. And what we have seen in the last year is a different scenario in which the EU basically has committed to provide the support that Ukraine needs. We need to see how this commitment, of course, is implemented. And essentially to offset the fact that the US is no longer providing financial support, even though, as we said, it still provides critically important military and intelligence support. That pivot of the EU, the fact that it's now accepted as a matter of consensus with, you know, the occasional discussion with Belgium, that the EU has to support Ukraine financially and keep providing the means for Ukraine's war, is a tremendous achievement, in my view, of the EU strategically. It's, of course, in the EU's own interest. The cost of that support, by the way, is trivial. It is in the tenths of percentage points of GDP. So we're talking, at this point, less than 0.5% of EU GDP for financial support to Ukraine, which is eminently affordable given the critical security benefit. And that pivot has been made in the last 12 months. I think it's an achievement that, of course, doesn't resolve the current problems, but it's important to acknowledge it.
Yeah, I mean, and if I can complement what Nicola said on this point, I think the financial support certainly is affordable, and it's a great sign that Europe has shown this leadership and has taken over the financial support without the US. But also in terms of sort of the strategic positioning, I mean, let's be frank. I think the German Chancellor, together with the French President and with the British Prime Minister, even now over this weekend, has managed to significantly influence the shape of the so-called peace plan. So I think European diplomacy has actually been quite effective, and it has been a sign of the leadership, certainly of the big countries, but I would say also of the EU as a whole, to take out the more controversial points in the plan, to set red lines, and to ensure and guarantee also to our Ukrainian friends that they are not left alone. And I think that's absolutely critical for Ukraine. It's absolutely critical for European security. And it's a sign of, I would say, increased capacities to act together. Now then, am I happy with where we are overall? I think we should still do better and, you know, have more capacities. And I think one critical capacity that makes us particularly dependent on the United States at this point is intelligence. So the battlefield intelligence that the US provides to the Ukrainians is extremely valuable and cannot easily be replaced by the type of battlefield intelligence that European armed forces at the moment can collect. And so I think we need to do major investments in that area, and we need to do them very fast. But overall, I agree with Nicolas here. Europe is stepping up quite significantly.
There's a couple of things I want to pick up on here. One of them is that the EU is, as you just said, Guntram, engaging seriously with this plan, even if the first draft of the plan was something that didn't seem serious in a lot of the ways that people had hoped. They are trying to turn it into something. We're also seeing, of course, the internal debate in the U.S. between the National Security Council and the Secretary of State and the authors of the plan and the White House to see how all that shakes out. But the other thing is the big political advances that this has brought. You know, post-Brexit, there's been a lot of discussion about where is the UK? Will the UK join financing for weapons? Will the UK participate in this or that? Is there equivalence for this or that? But with this, the UK has a seat at the table and is on the same side as the EU, and they're just working shoulder to shoulder, and it's unremarkable. People are just accepting it. And the same thing for the financial support. As Nicolas said, over the last year, the EU has realized that the money is something it can come up with and will have to come up with, that the US will not continue to have battles over coming up with another $60 billion for Ukraine here or there. And unremarkably, the EU has realized it can borrow from capital markets when it needs to. This is separate, of course, from the Eurocular plan, but the EU now has a Ukraine facility that it can tap whenever leaders give it the authority to, in these amounts that are small compared to the whole economy. And it's a joint borrowing capacity that's just there that people aren't arguing about the existence over. So I think that's pretty huge. In the second half of our podcast, I'd like to talk about next steps. We have an EU leaders summit on the calendar for mid-December, but it seems likely that if there's a breakthrough, they could have an emergency summit between now and then. We've got people at all levels talking. Would either of you like to offer some ideas about next steps or things to watch other than leaks in the papers?
No, I mean, I just to say one thing. I mean, I think the problem will be the revised proposal will look good from a European perspective, but Russia, I don't think has a fundamental interest in stopping the war at the current lines without subjugating Ukraine completely. So I think my interpretation is that the Russian president still wants to really subjugate Ukraine and essentially get rid of its sovereignty. If that's the Russian strategy, I think what it means is that the war will continue. And so basically it means it continues more or less as we've seen it in the last 12 months. And of course, Ukraine continues to be in a very difficult position, and arguably the position on both sides is getting more difficult. So on the Ukrainian side, I mean, you can really see lack of manpower is becoming a constraint. Ukraine needs more military support, continues to need more military support, including with far-ranging missiles to attack critical infrastructure in Russia. But on the Russian side, I think we are also seeing first signs that by now the regime is tapping into difficult economic territory, right? I mean, we've seen some reporting that gold is being sold. We are seeing some reporting that some soldiers might not fully get their pay. So also on the Russian side, I would say difficulties are probably increasing at this point. And so I mean, the hope we can have is that eventually, perhaps that's going to be more like next year, this war will at some stage stop because Putin will realize that he cannot basically take all of Ukraine. So I think that's where I would put my bet on.
I agree with Guntram. There's an asymmetry, of course, because we have much more transparency on Ukraine than on Russia, including, frankly, on the currents in Ukrainian society, the debate about corruption, and all the things that have surfaced in recent times, which, by the way, is good news. It shows that there is accountability and some elements of a rule of law in Ukraine, even so, of course, it's in a very complicated and difficult environment. So I don't want to sugarcoat it too much because corruption appears real and is a massive problem. But the fact that we observe it and we observe the action of the law enforcement agencies in Ukraine as we do has to be highlighted as, an essential difference. So we don't know exactly how secure Mr. Putin is and how secure he feels, which may be two different things. But there are, as Guntram said, indications that, time is not necessarily on his side. And here, I want to highlight the critical importance of the Russian, of the European financial support to Ukraine, because that's what makes a difference. Basically, it is the EU financial and the European more broadly, including British, Norwegian, and from others, it is the European EU-led financial support to Ukraine that provides an essential parameter at this point of the war in terms of timing, being quite possibly on Ukraine's side more than it is on Russian side. It is the point that President Trump didn't take into account when he memorably said in late February this year that Zelensky didn't have any cards. Zelensky had a card, which is EU support, which is much clearer now than it was then, but which was already observable then for people with ability to analyze. And I think this is really something to think hard about when thinking about the general balance of this war and the possible outcomes of this war.
I'd like to talk for a minute about the EU sanctions on Russia, and also the interconnections of the financial system. Nicola, how much does the EU have to work with the US in its effort to control some of these economic flows to Russia? Who's in charge of what parts of the global financial system, and what levers does Europe have to pull here?
Well, this is complicated because there are many different pieces to this. There is a purely financial piece, which is largely about the immobilization of the assets, and that's under the entire control of the EU. There are energy market pieces, which are about, the price cap and that kind of thing, and they're very multifaceted. I don't claim a lot of expertise on this, but there are many different bits. On this front, of course, somewhat ironically, the big game changer recently has been the President Trump's decision to sanction Lukoil and Rosneft, which has had observable impact on energy markets, maybe even more than Trump intended, we don't know, and has been very beneficial to Ukraine. I think it has to be mentioned. Then you have all the trade, which is largely a way to say weapons procurement, or the procurement of means to build weapons like machine tools and components, which is extremely complex. It's about complex supply chains that go all the way where China plays a big role, but also Central Asia, a number of third countries. And here the machinery of enforcement is a mix of EU heft as a big market vis-a-vis certain countries, but also, frankly, US intelligence capability and ability to monitor those systems, which is unparalleled and which the EU doesn't have. And then you have bits and pieces in the financial system, coming back to the starting point of your question, which can, you know, put sand in the wheels of trade, but cannot really block transactions. Remember that at the beginning of the war, all the talk was about de-swifting, was about SWIFT and the ability the EU had to cut off Russia from the SWIFT system. Well, now we know that this was not the kind of, you know, nuclear financial weapon, as it was described by some, that was claimed at the time, and that even so, there were sanctions taken disconnecting key Russian banks, including Sberbank, after a lag from SWIFT. That has not really impaired Russia's ability to procure stuff and to sell stuff in the ways that was sometimes alleged by, you know, some of the analysts. So it's been a lot of learning. There are many different bits when we talk about sanctions. And on some of them, the EU has a lot of control. On others, not that much.
Do you see a risk that the US and the EU could end up in different corners on some of these financial channels and end up fighting among themselves over who has more control?
Well, they already are. I mean, they've never been fully aligned. There were points in time of remarkable alignment, which was, you know, always triggered by individuals. The best example is the immobilization of the Russian reserves, which, as we all know, took Russia by surprise. The Central Bank of Russia had not counted on that scenario and had not properly prepared for it. And it is clear from media reports that both Americans like Janet Yellen and Europeans like particularly Mario Draghi and also Ursula von der Leyen played a big role in that decision. So it was a joint decision with an alignment of views at that time in late February 2022, just a few days after the beginning of the full-scale invasion. In normal times, there are plenty of differences between the positions of Europeans and Americans, and in some cases among Europeans in those financial matters. The most obvious one, which we haven't mentioned much for now, but with is kind of in the background, is the central role of the dollar in the global financial system, which was to be taken for granted until this year, but has been put into question, if not changed, by the actions of the Trump administration. And now for Europeans, inevitably, there is this additional question, which is, if the Trump administration manages to completely destroy the central position of the dollar in the global financial system, then what does that mean for the euro? Can the euro, in a way, substitute for the dollar as the key currency of the world? And how should we think about that? In that sense, and that's important to emphasize, this generates an additional argument not to confiscate the Russian reserves, but to do some clever financial engineering such as the reparations loan instead, because confiscation would undermine the position of the euro as a possible key currency in the global financial system. Even so, that may be shocking from a kind of morality standpoint. That's an obvious financial reality. So I think the clearer formulation by the EU and the European Commission that they are not going to confiscate the Russian cash no matter what, but they want to leverage it but not confiscate it, that is to be connected with the question marks about future global financial and especially global monetary landscape that have emerged since March, April. So lots of different dots to connect here.
Perhaps to complement a few points, one is on the effectiveness of the sanction regime and especially the export controls of critical technology. There we have studied that in some detail and have certainly remarked that initially, when the war started in 22, these export controls were highly effective. So we even at the time I published a piece in which I could show that the actual production of key military equipment, including things like trucks and tanks, was slowed down or impaired by the non-delivery of specific items. So I think we have seen here quite a success at the beginning. Now, the problem with a sanctions regime is, of course, always the size of the coalition of the countries that enforces it, right? And I think here with the Russian case specifically, we, of course, increasingly see that Russia is able to procure things from China, from Hong Kong, from the Middle East, from Central Asian countries, and these sort of additional export channels have become visible. Does that mean that sanctions are ineffective? No, because it still increases the cost to Russia to actually procure that kind of equipment. Now, if the US were to drop out of these kind of sanctions, which include, for example, sanctioning of chips produced by IBM, then that would mean that Russia would find it easier, of course, to secure some of these things. So in a sense, the coalition of sanctioning regimes would be smaller, and therefore it would be less effective. So I think this this remains a critical area. And despite claims that it's ineffective, these things do matter. They don't immediately change the regime, but they represent a cost to the Russian war machine, and I think we should certainly uphold that. And I mean, just to say on the financial side, when we come to the role of the euro in the global currency, I mean that's a big discussion, of course, which I guess deserves a separate podcast at some point. But I certainly think the key question from a European perspective is if we want to go down that road and play a bigger role as a global currency. Is the integration of our capital markets and, at the end of the day, the reserve, the reference asset that Europe at the moment doesn't fully have, right? So creating a European safe asset is, to my mind, a critical part of what Europe has to do to really gain more heft in the global competition around currencies.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how, by committing to being the rule of law people and continuing to be the rule of law people, the euro can maintain global confidence that it's a place to keep your money, even when you're not sure if your politics always align. Guntram, any closing thoughts or predictions for where we're going to end up with Ukraine in the next couple weeks or so?
Well, I mean, my main prediction is that it's going to be murky and that this war will not be over this year. I think it will continue. Yeah, I think the critical point is Europe needs to continue supporting Ukraine and building its own capabilities that are separate. That's what we need. But it's going to remain very difficult for, I would say, another half a year.
Thanks for that. Nicola, as we wrap up, I'd love to get a few more thoughts from you on the transatlantic dimension. The Trump administration is known for its inconsistency on any number of policy areas, and on this one in particular, seems to be working on some pretty unrelated tracks. So how do we process what's coming out of that, and how do you see things shaking up between the different facets of U.S. policy and the EU in coming weeks?
I mentioned the conflicting impulses at the very top of this regime, namely at the level of the president, and the fact that these, for him, it is clear that there are conflicting considerations that often collide with each other, and that is reflected in, you know, the back and forth in terms of his policy orientation. So we'll have more of that. This is President Donald Trump. It was already visible during his first term. It has been exacerbated during the second term because, frankly, he has more power. That will not change as long as he is in charge. I think the question is, how can the Europeans maneuver that environment and, if not really use it to their advantage, because I think it's maybe putting the bar too high, but at least protect against the biggest risk that this entails for Europe. I think, frankly, the Europeans have gotten better at that. And we've seen that in the diplomacy of the last few months, following the Trump-Putin meeting in Alaska, following the Trump-Putin phone calls that resulted in their planned meeting in Budapest that in the end didn't happen. Also on other fronts, let me just mention Greenland as an illustration. I think the Europeans have adapted their playbook by basically not seeking symbolic victories over Trump, which is pro would probably be counterproductive, but essentially avoiding the more detrimental outcomes from materializing. That gives the EU a very bad press because precisely because they're not seeking symbolic outcomes, all the headlines are Trump wins, the EU is weak. But that doesn't necessarily correspond to the reality of the developments we're seeing. And I want to say something more about the currency question because, as Guntram just said, it's so important. The fact that the EU has demonstrated agency by increasing, not decreasing, its financial support to Ukraine, while the US was decreasing it and essentially terminating its financial support to Ukraine, is not just a demonstration of autonomy, but it's actually a demonstration of impact on something that matters for the global security situation. And that has read across for in terms of currencies and the monetary order, because we know from ample observation, a very abundant literature, that this issue of key currencies is linked to hard power, geopolitical considerations. And the assumption until now was that the EU doesn't have that, full stop. Now we're in a more complicated situation where the EU obviously doesn't have full strategic autonomy. We have these critical dependencies on the US that Guntram emphasized and that are a major problem, to state the obvious. But the EU also has agency and has demonstrated agency on things that matter for global security. So when thinking about the future monetary landscape, actually, global capital allocators have to think about these kind of things.
Yeah, and also anything that brings the EU closer together helps the euro because fragmentation risk has always been one of the things holding the common currency back.
At this point, nobody talks about breakup of the euro. So to the extent there are issues of possible fragmentation, they're about non-Eurozone countries. There are fewer and fewer of them. We'll have Bulgaria in the euro by January 1st, and it certainly won't be the last.
Well, let's hope that it stays together. There is still some contingency planning for if the euro were to be threatened again, but certainly for the moment, it seems strong. Thank you so much, Guntram Wolf and Nicolas Véran, for joining us on this podcast today. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. We have been discussing the situation in Ukraine and the dueling peace plans and how the EU will handle the last couple of weeks of the year. You can find all of our research and commentary on this on our website, bruegel.org. Thanks for listening. See you next time.